This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Cookbooks are a lone shining light in all of the publishing industry at the moment. Last year, more than 20,000 cookbooks were published and more than 60 million of them were sold. That's a 9% increase over the year before. Now, the best-selling cookbook to date is by actress Gwyneth Paltrow, and that leads to the question, what do we expect from our cookbooks? What are we getting from them? Do we read cookbooks to learn something about cooking or about living a vicarious life? Two new cookbooks this fall fall into the, this year, in fact, fall into the Learn Something camp. One book is The Great American Cookbook, a reissue of Clementine Paddleford's classic from 1960. The other is Ruhlman's 20, and it is by writer and cook Michael Ruhlman. Kelly Alexander wrote the biography of Clementine Paddleford called Hometown Appetites and edited the reissue of Clementine's cookbook. She wrote a new introduction as well. Kelly Alexander and Michael Ruhlman are with me here in the studio to talk about how America eats and reads about it. Welcome back to both of you. It's good to have you here.
Thanks.
Good to be here.
Let's start with a look at how these are organized. Michael, you have this concept of the elements that are required for cooking, and they're not all necessarily the same. They're not ingredients. They're, you know, we've got onions and sugar, yeah, but also roast and braise. So mm-hmm. It's how to and what to put in.
I wanted to simplify cooking as much as possible. I was talking with a cookbook editor at a food writer symposium who was lamenting that he loved to cook but couldn't get any better. He plateaued, and I said, Bill, there's only about 20 things you need to know in order to cook anything. And his eyes brightened. He said, now that's a book I can get behind. And so I went about thinking about what really do we need to know in order to cook everything. And that's how 20 came about.
That's great. And you've got techniques in there, too, including how to clarify butter. I mean, which for me is whenever they – and you get to these things in the recipe. They say clarified butter, and you stop. You turn it over because you don't know how to do that.
Mm-hmm. And we've got lots of photographs showing you how – we wanted to document how food should really look in your kitchen.
Kelly, Clementine organized her cookbook, oddly enough, by state. This is a book that came out in 1960. I mean, that's a kind of an odd way to put together a cookbook.
It's odd when you think about traditional cookbook publishing and the way that conventional wisdom works with cookbooks, which is that you should eat through it like a meal, appetizer, soups, entrees, desserts. But you have to remember that Clementine was a newspaper columnist, and she was always filing her columns by the dateline. So we kept that spirit in the book. She organized her recipes by state, her massive files, everything was by state. And it's a more fun way to sort of go about it. The book isn't just recipes. I wanted to really emphasize the fact that it's a history. So that seemed like the best way to organize it.
And is that some of what's behind the success of cookbooks in an industry? I mean, if you think about it, they're all online. We can get the recipes anywhere. And yet there's something about the artifact, the photos.
Why people like to read cookbooks is such a complicated question, because I think there's a big part of it that's a vicarious thrill of reading about food that you might never cook. And I think about that in the case of Gwyneth Paltrow in a bigger way. I think Michael and I are writing cookbooks for people who really do want to be in the kitchen. So there's a big divide, I would say, right there. Do you agree?
Well, yeah. And in Gwyneth Paltrow's case, I think food by people who never eat, really.
Right. There's definitely that argument to me. I mean, I've never seen her eat anything, but that's
– But Michael, what do you think?
I think that people want to know how to cook. I think we've been taught by – food processors, the food industry, by the fast food industry, the cooking is too hard, that they're going to make our lives so easy by cooking our food for us. And I think we've given up a lot because of that, and people want it back. They want their kitchens back. They want their kitchen tables back. They realize how important cooking at home is, how important is their family, their health, their budget. So many reasons now. And so we don't need recipes. We're awash in recipes. What we need is a little technique and a little confidence in the kitchen.
And some of those fundamentals. What is braising? What is blanching? And once I can do that, then I can mix and match. I've got the creativity to swap out the vegetables, no problem.
Right. And there's a certain amount of instruction now that we are so used to. I was dealing with historic recipes. They were collected between 1948 and 1960, and not a single one of them, if you were going to make a roast, for example, in the archives, none of the recipes started with preheat the oven to 350 degrees, because a cook in 1955 would have already known that's what you were supposed to do. Now you have to say it in, you know, 20 minutes before you want, you know.
Yeah.
The reason for that is because we stopped cooking for a generation. So all the stuff that was naturally passed down because we had to cook for ourselves stopped being passed down. So we required those very specific instructions, which really is, it's impossible to write a recipe that can account for all the nuances that you will find in a kitchen when you're cooking a meal.
I agree. Anytime you ever watch a professional chef cook, I'm always amazed at the things that they don't tell you, right? You notice that the cook might throw in a little salt or might add a little extra flour, and they don't think to mention it because it's so much a part of their process. And when you become a confident cook, that becomes part of what you do, right? It's part of not being a slave to a recipe. It's part of knowing how to make something in the kitchen all by yourself.
Though what is the big fear of most young cooks or inexperienced cooks is that this is not about a recipe. It's about some kind of feel that I don't have. I have to know how the dough feels, and I'll never learn that. And you can't tell me how.
There is a certain degree of arrogance that comes with I hear a lot of chefs in interviews saying that they want to take a classic recipe and make it their own. And I think that's like, well, what is really wrong with the original Caesar salad that you have to feel like you have to add guacamole to it or whatever the thing is? So there's the other side of that.
Or the horrific chicken Caesar salad.
Right. Chicken Caesar salad.
An emblem of mediocrity in America.
You mean just layering stuff on top of what was already perfectly good.
Yeah.
Perfectly good recipe.
Yeah, the skim milk of the protein world.
You can now, and the interesting thing too is that one of the ways all of these thoughts have come to us is through food writing. Clementine, of course, in a sense, the original food writer in the sense that she raised it to a kind of an art. Remind us a little bit about her contribution to food writing.
So I've got you so convinced now that Clementine is part of the food writing pantheon. I love it. And it's true. The earliest days of food writing in America were women on farms who were writing down recipes, receipts, they called them. It was passing down of an oral tradition from mother to daughter to daughter. Then we moved off of the farm. Everything got really spread out. And that's when cookbooks became necessary, when you no longer live so close to your family. Newspaper food sections started running recipes, but they only ran formulas. It was literally the recipe and nothing else. And home economists were behind that. And then Clementine came along and was a real reporter. She was a trained journalist. And her idea was to tell the stories behind the cooks, that made it so much more interesting. And she was, in her day, wildly successful at doing that. And she paved the way for the Food Network and all of this sort of dialogue that we have now.
Michael, what's the most fun about being a food writer for you?
It's not the food. It's the people. It's all the things that surround the food. That's what's so great. I mean, food is really a metaphor for so many things about how we live and how we live well. And so that's what I care about when I write about food.
And you can really get into regional and cultural identity, which is one of the interesting ways. And when you think about organizing a cookbook by state, you can think about, you know, regions and what happens there. I mean, I think about the key lime pie, which in Clementine's time would have been kind of an exotic thing, right? I mean, 1960, who could get a key lime? Right?
So the thing that you can't ever escape in food writing is your personal peccadilloes, no matter how hard you try. So you say key lime pie. Clementine was an amazing sweet tooth. So we had an archive of more than 800 recipes. Half of them were for cake and pie. That wasn't really reflective of the way America was eating. That was a reflection of her personal taste. Yeah. The other part of it is that the book is organized by state and it's grouped by region. So there's the South, the Midwest, and then there's one chapter just called Florida, because Clementine grew up on a farm in Kansas, and to her, Florida was the most exotic, exciting place ever. And key lime pie was the epitome of what an amazing dessert could be. It was a combination of her favorite things, sweets and Florida. But that was one of the first published recipes for key lime pie in a national newspaper ever.
Yeah, and it must have been exotic to a lot of people, again, because it wasn't available in many supermarkets. I would think New York State would be
It would have been
rough.
Really so, hard know. To find a key lime then. It's kind of hard to find one now. So.
Yeah. But Michael, these days, it's harder and harder, is it not, to find something exotic? And is there a kind of lust for that? I mean, getting back to the chicken Caesar salad, this need to find the next exotic weird thing in a globalized world.
I almost think that we've gotten past that. We want something that's really local, that's really unusual, that somebody hasn't found that grows right in your backyard, because for a time we could get anything anywhere. I mean, there are actually key limes in my grocery store in Cleveland right now. So there's nothing exotic. What becomes exotic is, you know, something is the Morel mushrooms that you found in your backyard.
You were about to say something, Kelly.
Yes, it's a total full circle. You know, in the beginning, we were locavores in America. You could only eat what grew nearby, right? Then you could have everything, and this was perceived as great. You could have tomatoes in January, and that was awesome. Now that's terrible, and what's really great that's is right. being a locavore. So you sort of have to roll with that.
I'm talking today with Kelly Alexander, who has written a new introduction to the Great American Cookbook, 500 Time-Tested Recipes by Clementine Paddleford. Michael Ruhlman is with me as well. His new cookbook is 20 Techniques, 100 Recipes. It's called Ruhlman's 20. Tell us about the recipes now. How did you determine which recipes to put in here?
Well, I went through each technique, whether it's a food tool like salt or water or onion, or whether it's a way of applying heat, whether it's braise or poach, and I tried to come up with recipes that showcased each technique or ingredient.
And then did you now? How do you do that in terms of sorting out? I mean, do you do the one that demonstrates the technique the best way, or is it the same thing? This is just my favorite recipe. I'm putting it in the book.
No, it was which demonstrated the idea that I wanted to get across. For instance, I wanted to show how powerful water is in the kitchen, that you don't need stocks. In fact, you know, if you roast a chicken in a pan, if you throw some onions and carrots and there's still some chicken left in the pan, you've got all the makings for a great stock and sauce right there if you just add water, which is a great flavor extractor. It pulls out the sugars and the amino acids, And then the water leaves the pan, and you've got this caramelized goodness on the bottom of the pan. You add more water, it lifts that goodness off the pan, and you have a sauce. That's how you have sauce. And if you understand that that's how water works, you can do that in many applications.
On the State of Things today, we're talking about food. Talk about some of the recipes in Clementine Paddleford's cookbook. Let me ask you this. Because it is a book that was written a long, long time ago, and it was on that threshold between, you know, off the farm
foods,
and convenience.
Yeah.
I mean, there have to be recipes in this book, Kelly, that you would just never in a million years make.
So there are about 500 recipes in the book, and we started with more than 800. So the duds kind of got weeded out. There are still some in the book that aren't my absolute favorite that probably needed to be representative of the time. There were a ton of potato salads, so the question became which potato salad is most important, and one of the ones we left in is called green potato salad. It's a potato salad with a whole ton of dried herbs. I can safely tell you I would never make that, but it's kind of an interesting period piece, and it is actually green when you make it, which is a big part of why I wouldn't make it. But
a lot of potato salads, and there's a fair amount of cream of mushroom soup.
There's some cream of mushroom soup.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's some casseroles. And the book is definitely not for somebody who thinks casserole is a bad word. I don't. I think a casserole can be a really great thing. There are plenty without cream of mushroom soup, but there are a couple that we left in because that's how they did it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what about, are there any recipes in this that you think cannot be improved?
I'm not a particular sweet tooth, but there is a chocolate cake in there called Aunt Sabella's Black Chocolate Cake. It's from a Pennsylvania Dutch family. It's a really thin layer, one layer with really rich fudge icing. I think if you were going to make one cake in your life, it's that cake. It's perfect.
That's the one. What about it in this book, Michael? Again, 100 recipes. Are there other recipes that you'd like to sort of append to these, or recipes that you threw away that thought, oh, I'd love to put that in, but I'm going to stick with 100?
I wanted to keep things simple.
Yeah.
I wanted to keep things clean and basic for the home cook. This is meant for people who want to get better at cooking, who like cooking and want to get better at. So I want to make good home cooking. But things like a butter poached shrimp with grits is great. Butter poaching shrimp is absolutely the best way to cook shrimp, I'm convinced.
And describe that for us. How do we do that?
You melt butter and keep it emulsified by melting it in small chunks in a little bit of water. So you've got liquid butter, but it's not separated out. And then you poach the shrimp there.
Kind of a low heat. Then.
Very low heat, about 150 degrees. So lobster and shrimp really like gentle heat, and it keeps them very, very tender. And the shrimp flavor of the butter, which you add to the grits, and it's just a fabulous way to do shrimp and grits.
So now what's going to happen? I've got this butter. I'm adding it a piece at a time. Mm-hmm. What's the ratio here of water to butter?
It doesn't matter. You just need to start it in about a little tablespoon of water, because butter has water in it already. So every time you add some butter, you're adding a little more water, which will keep it emulsified.
And that keeps going and keeps it from burning. Mm-hmm. And then I can slowly cook the shrimp or the lobster. Now, what about the grits? Do I take that, what's left over from that, and then mix that into
the grits? You would enrich the grits finally before serving them with some of the shrimp-flavored butter.
Are we getting, Kelly, these days, are we getting back to cooking? We know there is a move to sustainable farming. People are showing up at the farmers markets. That's all good. So it means we're taking the time to process our own food. Still a tiny movement?
No, I think Michael's absolutely right. Somewhere in the middle of Clementine Paddleford and now, everybody forgot how to really cook. There was a huge rise of food culture in America, but not a lot of food instruction. Food became trendy, but cooking it and the very basic things really fell out of favor. So like Michael, I run into a lot of people who don't know how to do really sort of simple things. Baked cookies is hard. And it's I do think people are longing to know how to do it again, not just what's good about it, but how to make it.
And Michael, a couple of things you've said so far have suggested the importance of chemistry. I mean, you don't need to know it as chemistry, but you talked about the way water works. Acid is an important part of the book. I mean, tell us about what we should know about acid.
Acid, first and foremost, is a great seasoning device. It heightens flavors. It makes things brighter and more flavorful. But it also denatures protein. So if you put acid on fish, you will cook the fish. And it's what gives us ceviche, a raw fish salad that's cooked with lime juice. So if you know how these very fundamental foods work, you become very flexible
as a cook. And need to know where you find acid. So those are going to be in citrus juices and in vinegar and that sort of thing.
Exactly.
And does it make much of a difference? Can you call it an acid and not really care which acid you use? Or when does it make a difference whether you use lime juice or vinegar?
It doesn't really. I don't think it matters in terms of flavor. I wouldn't want to put red wine vinegar on a nice, delicate, piece of fish. But citrus goes great with fish. But if you're seasoning, say, a rich, creamy cream of broccoli soup, then you might want a white wine vinegar, because that's what goes well with that kind of cooking.
What I'd love for people to take from what Michael is saying is that you can't do it wrong. Even if you don't have any idea about how proteins break down and how the amino acids work, what you should hear is that if you have a squirt of fresh lemon juice on roasted chicken, it will make it so much better, right? If you use a little bit of acid as a seasoning and not be afraid to do that, your food's a lot better.
And does it matter when you put it on?
Sure it matters, because if you put it in too early, it can dissipate. If you're using it as a seasoning, then you'd want it at the end.
And that's very intuitive, right? You want that nice, bright hit of lemon to be the first thing that goes into your mouth.
Right. But people are – I mean, I would worry that I'm going to end up having this thing taste like, lemonade, and I want chicken.
Well, you can only use a little bit.
A little bit.
Or what you do is what I was taught in culinary school is take a spoonful of whatever you're serving, say it was that cream of broccoli soup, and just put a drop of lemon juice or vinegar or red wine vinegar and taste it. And do it that way so you don't ruin a whole batch of soup.
Taste as you go, critical, right? I mean,
got
you can't just keep reading the book and putting it in.
I cannot imagine serving even my kids food that I didn't know how it tasted. And I know people do that all the time. I mean, you can adjust those seasonings on the spot. You've got to know. I mean, that's the way to get to be a better cook.
A reader of my book has pointed out that how you've forgotten this main step in your recipes. You've got to tell them to taste at each step.
Every
and,
step.
And they're right.
Thank you both for being on the program. What a pleasure.
Pleasure
Thanks.
To be here.
Kelly Alexander, editor of the reissue of Clementine Paddleford's classic, The Great American Cookbook. She also wrote the introduction. Michael Ruhlman's new cookbook is called Ruhlman's 20. Michael's going to be signing books tomorrow, Wednesday, at 11 o'clock, A Southern Season in Chapel Hill. And then tomorrow night, he's going to attend a special dinner prepared by award-winning chef Andrea Rusing at Lantern in Chapel Hill. Seats are available. Go to lanternrestaurant.com for more information about that. Coming up after a short break, the Latin American Film Festival turns 25. Stay tuned to the State of Things.